tonight on Arena. Stephen Benedict on Toy Story at 30, the Tulka Literary Journal at 10, and a new show, Evil, at the Project Arts Theatre. Welcome along to Wednesday night's Arena. You can text us as usual on 51551. Our WhatsApp these days is 0870 32 32 32. Email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. Now, 30 years ago, you're possibly not going to want to hear that, the world of animated film was blown open by a movie about a group of toys who are fully alive, but only when their owner wasn't looking. Toy Story was the world's very first feature-length computer animated film and changed the genre forever. It earned $400 million, spawned three sequels with one more on the way, made billions in merchandise sales, and introduced the world to the brilliance of Pixar Animation Studios. Let's remind ourselves a little of the magic.
According to my Nava computer, the...
Shut up! Just shut up, you idiot!
Sheriff, this is no time to panic.
This is the perfect time to panic! I'm lost, Andy is gone, they're gonna move from their house in 2 days and it's all your fault!
My fault? If you hadn't pushed me out of the window in the first place...
Oh, yeah, well, if you hadn't shown up your stupid little cardboard spaceship and taken away everything that was important to me...
Don't talk to me about importance. Because of you, the security of this entire universe is in jeopardy.
What? What are you talking about?
Right now, poised at the edge of the galaxy, Emperor Zurg has been secretly building a weapon with the destructive capacity to annihilate an entire planet. I alone have information that reveals this weapon's only weakness. And you, my friend, are responsible for delaying my rendezvous with Star Command!
You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear, you're an action figure! You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man, and you have my pity. Farewell.
It's still funny even now. That's Tim Allen as Buzz Lightyear and Tom Hanks as Woody the Cowboy. Stephen Benedict has been re-watching this little gem, and he joins me now in studio. Stephen, we'll come to the actual film itself in a minute, but maybe start by outlining the state of animation in the kind of early to mid-1990s when Toy Story came along.
Can I cheat and go back a little bit further to the 1980s?
Because
animation was all but on its knees. The biggest show in town... biggest studio animation studio in town in Hollywood in the 1980s was Disney, and they really weren't producing animated feature films at all, and what they were producing wasn't connecting with audiences. And then along came a guy called Jeffrey Katzenberg, and he revitalized the animation division in Disney. And in 1989 they released The Little Mermaid, in 1991 Beauty and the Beast, and in 1994 The Lion King. And those films were each incrementally got bigger and bigger and bigger and more successful. But what they all had in common was that they're all done with traditional hand animation drawings. And so computer-generated images and computer-generated animation was very, very exclusive to specific moments in very, very special effects-driven, high-end, expensive pictures. The best example would be The Terminator Part 2, when you think of the silver T-1000. And so when Toy Story arrived, it provided a new look to animation. And although the movie was rapturously received and embraced by audiences, there were a few skeptics amongst the animation fraternity themselves, because they were saying, we're not so much concerned about what is on offer here, it's how it's being offered, because they were convinced that computers were going to take over everything. Does this sound in any way, shape, familiar?
We may be having a 1995 discussion in 2025.
Yeah. So what they did, what John Lasseter, the director of the film, had to do when he came out to release the film, and he was doing the publicity, he was basically explaining the computers were nothing more than a very new set of very, very expensive pencils. And so if I can draw a comparison between what Lasseter was doing at Pixar, and we go back into the history of art, we'll go back to 1841. There was an American painter called John G. Rand, and he was browned off having to go down to the supplier's shop, buy pigment in dry form, go home, grind the colours, mix them with oil and thinner, and then and only then finally address the canvas. So he came up with an idea. How about we stuff paint into a tube? And that liberated the artist from the studio. They could go out into the fields. And because of that, then we have a new art form called Impressionism. So Pixar are to animation what John G. Rand was to painting. That is how revolutionary the arrival of Pixar and Toy Story is.
But when Pixar was set up originally, it wasn't an animation studio to begin with, was it?
No, this is hilarious. This is really, really funny. As you said, they had nothing to do with the film at the beginning. They were actually... They made high-end computer hardware aimed at the medical industry. They were finding it really, really hard to break into that market, so they turned to one of their employees, a guy called John Lasseter, who I just mentioned, to demonstrate to people what their computers could do. Now, Lasseter had a background in animation. He was one of the first graduates of the animation course in the California Institute of Arts, CalArts. And he was the graduate of the animation course, which had been set up by none other than Walt Disney. And get this, in that graduating class, there was John Lasseter and his buddy was Tim Burton. Okay, can you imagine being a tutor trying to teach those guys? So anyway, what happened was Lasseter gave Pixar, what he gave them was cartoons that were drawn up with the assistance of a computer. The important here is the assistance of the computer. And when we mention computers, we've got to mention one of the greatest visionaries of our age, Steve Jobs, because as we know, Jobs was one of the founders of Apple. But in 1985, he was fired by that company. And in 1986, he bought Pixar for the princely sum of $5 million. And he provided the technical foundation that would revolutionize animation.
I remember myself the concerns at the time, the whole idea that computer animation wasn't going to have the same warmth as cell-drawn animation, it wouldn't have the same charm, that it would feel different to a point where it wouldn't necessarily engage audiences. That's what Toy Story came into.
Yeah, the sense was it was going to be antiseptic. But the thing was, as Lasseter was saying, the computer is just a brand new pencil. That's all it is. And what was traditional about the storytelling technique and the storytelling craft in Toy Story and what Pixar were doing is that it relied on plot and relied on character. And the thing is, when you watch the film, there is breathtaking emotional precision. Now, I know that sounds like a fancy pants term, but if you think about it, the character of Woody is a skeptic, manic skeptic. And the character of Buzz is this delusional idealist. And they're the yin and yang to each other. And it is that conflict that propels the entire story. And because their emotional states are so clear, the audience fully engage with what's going on. And so that's the traditional aspect of the story. The computer aspect is just the gloss. It's the cover. It's the superficial point of it. But clearly, the simplicity of the premise of the film is the reason why it works. The premise of is the film. Do toys come alive when we're not there? And that is the fantasy of every child.
And I want to get into that. Before we do that, I do want to hear a little bit, though, of John Lasseter.
Right.
This great clip of him from 1995, and he's explaining how the film was made.
What's interesting is it's a very common belief that when computers come into a new artistic medium, you know, it reminds me a lot of when photography was invented. Everybody thought that painting was going to get replaced. But what computer animation does is it has a whole new look, you know. But the key word is animation. Animation, by definition, is making a motion picture frame by frame by frame by frame. And that doesn't change. We labor over every single frame. And so I worked on Toy Story for over 4 years. The full production was 2.5 years. The difference between Toy Story and Lion King or Pocahontas, it looks different. It's more dimensional. I was trained as a traditional animator. I love Disney animation. I love, you know, Warner Brothers cartoons. That's what I grew up on. You know, and I got really excited about animation. I was trained as a traditional animator, drawing, design, all that. But what excited me when I first saw my first computer animation back in about 1981 was that it was three-dimensional. You were able to create a world that was totally dimensional. You were able to move in and around objects, which you had never been able to do in hand-drawn animation. And so therefore, that got me so excited. And I think what Toy Story was different on is what made it unique is that we chose a subject matter, toys being alive, that really lent itself beautifully to the medium.
It's an interesting point that John Lasseter makes there, and it's one you've alluded to already. The idea that just because a film is made with computers as opposed to traditional cell animation, it doesn't make it any shorter a process, really.
No, they spent 4 years making the film. And the amazing thing is that they were they were inventing the technology as they went in order to tell the story that they wanted to tell. Just to go back, there's a beautiful sequence in Beauty and the Beast from 1991, which actually uses an early form of CG. It's the ballroom sequence.
Ballroom dance, yeah.
And the mapping of that space and the 3D space, as Lasseter referred to there, would be really, really hard for an animator to do that in an accurate way. So the CG helped and stepped in. But, you know, just to go back to the thing about the toys, the brilliant thing about the show in Toy Story is the toys love Andy more than he loves them. And that's what kids want to know. So that's the emotional core of it. But the thing is, when they're making Toy Story, they ran into an enormous amount of difficulty. And so much so that about a year and a half, two years into making the film, they had to stop. Because they sat down, they watched a very, very rough cut of the movie and they said, this isn't working at all. And why wasn't it working is the tone is completely wrong. Woody was a bully in the original version and they said, the tone is completely wrong. It's not going to connect with audiences. They shut the whole thing down. And Pixar and Disney were seriously considering axing the entire film, ditching the entire thing. But they decided, no, we'll go back and we'll start again from scratch. And when they started again from scratch, they started to engage with two specific writers, incredibly gifted writers. One was a guy called Pete Docter, and he went on to write and direct Up and Inside Out, both of which won the Academy Award. Another writer on the team was Andrew Stanton, who won the Academy Award for Finding Nemo and WALL-E. So when Toy Story was released in 1995, it became the first animated feature film ever to be nominated for Best Original Screenplay. It's the storytelling, not the technology.
It is easy to forget that, isn't it? That realistically, the success of Toy Story is all about what a brilliant piece of writing it is.
It is. And it goes back, you know, to the situation, the premise, the toys come to life. And we've seen that beforehand with the Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky, and the magic of Christmas and the association with Christmas, the toys. When I go to sleep on Christmas night, the toys are still alive. So the kids going to see that movie really, really resonated with them. But there are other things that really make the film a great impact on what it was. The casting, the voice casting is brilliant. I mean, Tom Hanks, if you've ever seen him on a talk show, he is incredibly animated as a guest. So you can only imagine. He tells actually a funny story. He was on the Graham Norton show one time explaining what it is like to record the voice of Woody. And so he's basically in a glass booth and he's roaring his lungs out for 4 or 5 hours. And then they give him a note, the producers and the director behind the glass, say, Tom, just think of this for a second. And they go into silence. They're talking to each other back and forth behind the glass. And Tom's going, what are they talking about? And they come back and said, try it a little bit quicker this time. And Tom Hanks goes into another 4-hour version of the variations and trying to deliver that line. But for me, I think the secret sauce is the music and Randy Newman's music, because the title of the song, You've Got a Friend in Me, that for me is what the secret sauce of the whole film is about. It's about friendship. It's about knowing you have a place to live, knowing you have a place of being safe, and knowing that you're loved. It's that simple and that hard.
These days, having Randy Newman write a song for your animation seems like a no-brainer given what's happened since then. But his run of writing songs for animation begins with Toy Story, and then he writes them for Pixar film after Pixar film after Pixar film. He was a strange choice.
Yes, very. I mean, this is the guy who wrote You Can Leave Your Hat On. He also wrote this very, very dark song in Germany before the war. And you're saying to yourself, how on earth did somebody think of matching this guy to this kid's film? So whoever came up with that idea is really, really stuck in a stroke of genius.
Why has the franchise been so successful? And I realise we're at film number 4 at this point. 5 is already, they're pre-trailing it and it's on the way. Why has it survived? What's its longevity?
Well, because they're toys. You've got the real life characters from the movie coming down off the screen into your own bedroom, and you're hiding underneath your own bed and you're tumbling down the stairs with Mr. Slinky, and all of a sudden Mr. Potato Head is on the kitchen table. And these are exact renditions of what you're seeing on the screen. You mentioned the merchandising there. The merchandising from the Toy Story franchise has earned $11 billion. So in actual fact, the movies, which have earned 3, are nothing more than 90-minute commercials for what's available in the foyer.
It became the beginning of this run, not just for Pixar, but for the concept of computer-generated animation. You don't think twice about it these days, but Pixar's run that begins with Toy Story is exceptional.
Yeah, you have. Then you've got A Bug's Life. You've got Wally. I'm losing the chronology here, but you've got Finding Nemo. You've got Monsters, Inc. And it was almost a case of every time that they released a picture, it was going to be nominated for Best Animated Feature. But that tide benefited all ships, because now you've got a franchise like Zootropolis is coming out, the sequel next week. There's also The Minions. You've got Frozen. All these fantastic computer animated pictures. And if you think back to what was not on offer in the 1980s and the early 1990s, what Katzenberg did is immeasurable. His impact on the animation genre or the animation style in Hollywood is beyond measure.
The industry warmed to it eventually, didn't it? In a way that might not have been thinkable in 1995 initially when the first film came out.
No, I mean, yeah. The interesting thing is, it's like I equated a little bit to what the Beatles did when the Beatles toured the United States the second time. Beatlemania had already struck America in 1964, but by the time they came back in 1965. The police were notifying Brian Epstein, their manager, that there were more kids outside these theatres than there were inside. And as a consequence, Brian Epstein said, looked across the street and he says, "What's that?" And they said, "That's a baseball stadium." He says, "We'll fill that instead." And so the Beatles, through that, invented stadium rock. They didn't know that they were inventing it. But when Katzenberg and Steve Jobs and John Lasseter sat down to make Toy Story, they had no idea what was going to come as a consequence. But that little germ of that an idea completely changed the game. And I think the next question is, what's going to happen next? Because as we mentioned, we alluded to it there at the beginning, AI is the big thing coming over the hill. So who knows where animation is going to go and if it's going to be able to maintain that magic, that jouissance that is so essential to storytelling, which is the human element.
There was an immense fear in around the time of Toy Story as well, that it might kill off cell-drawn animation completely, but that hasn't happened at all.
That's the beautiful thing. It just offered, as John Lasseter said, a different set of pencils. And, you know, he said there that when photography came along, people thought it was going to get rid of painting, and it didn't. And so when recorded music came along, they thought it was going to get rid of live music, and it didn't. So we have, you know, the Cartoon Saloon here in Ireland, and they're making beautiful animated pictures, which are being nominated for the Academy Awards in Los Angeles. And they've got Studio Ghibli in Japan. You've got fantastic films coming out of there, you know, Howl's Moving Castle or Spirited Away, which are completely different, not only in terms of their techniques and the animation technique and the hand-drawn, but also the storytelling themselves and the characters are completely different from the really, really high manic energies that you constantly get in the Hollywood animation pictures, to the point that you think that they're feeding the characters Skittles. There's so much sugar racing around in those shows that you think they're going to develop diabetes.
Stephen Benedict, thank you so much for talking to us about 30 years of Toy Story. We're going to finish with that Oscar-nominated song from the very first Toy Story. This is Randy Newman, and You Got a Friend in Me.
You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
Pan Pan Theatre has teamed up with the highly respected Australian company Aphids to bring us Eiffel, a new show that takes a hard look at what artists go through when creating great works. The play is set in the fictional Eiffel School of Performance Arts, a pressure cooker of an academy where students are driven to the brink and forced to make sacrifices to make something genius. Drawing on Faust's Devilish Bargain, Cantor's Haunted Theatre, old manifestos and dog-eared acting manuals, Eiffel poses the question, how much of your life must you have to give away to be called brilliant? To tell me more, I'm joined by Aphids co-artistic director Mish Grigor and Pan Pan's artistic director Gavin Quinn. You're both very welcome to Arena tonight.
Welcome.
Mish, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about the company Aphids. It's an artist-led organisation that focuses on collaborative risk-taking work.
Yeah, so Aphids is a 30-year-old collective based out of Melbourne in Australia. And originally it began as a collaboration between an experimental sound maker, a fashion designer, a theatre person and a visual artist who started putting on events and running sort of experiments into what happened when they put their different art forms together. And then over the decades, it's sort of been handed on, the baton of the company has been handed on to different collaborations or different groups who are also interested in kind of work that fits in between the cracks of art forms, or what happens when you collaborate with people who are artists or who don't call themselves artists, or people who want to work across more experimental ways of working. And so I'm the current Karu director with a woman called Lara Toms, and we sort of work together making performance out of Australia and collaborating. And yeah, we're sort of very much holding that history and very proud that the company's managed to keep going and change forms as it does reflect the practice of each person or people who are in the directing roles at different times.
So Gavin, tell me then how Pan Pan become involved with this in Dublin.
So I've known Mish about 20 years just from performing in festivals in Australia. And so Mish has worked with us on a number of shows, one which is The First Bad Man, which is a performative book club based on the novel by Miranda July, which we've, you know, toured in America and Lincoln Center and toured to Germany and other places. And then Mish and I also collaborated making a show in the Malt House called The Temple with Australian artists in 2019. So we've been sort of every few years we've been making shows together, and I was well aware of Aphids. And I guess with Pan Pan, as well as international touring, we've become more and more interested in collaborating with international artists and, you know, really kind of experimenting what it means to be international. And it's kind of a community of like people who work in experimental work and performance all over the world. And we've been trying to sort of, you know, drag in these great people to Ireland and, you know, steal all their ideas and learn from them.
Talk to me about that collaboration and about how that works, Gavin, because obviously when you're working with another company, you want to each bring your own strengths to it. But then there has to be some sort of way you delineate roles, or you delineate who brings what to where.
Exactly, yeah. With collaboration, and you know, obviously theatre by its very nature is a collaborative art form, and normally there's a very hierarchical structure, you know, going back hundreds of years. And but in this situation, collaboration is finding an atmosphere where you can take on people's ideas, learn to say no. Collaboration obviously is 90% saying no and 10% yes, and it's actually looking at what are the skills of the different skills of people, such as performers, directors, designers, people who work in kind of more conceptual ideas like the dramaturg department. And it's sort of just creating, it's hard to describe exactly, but it's creating an atmosphere where people feel like they can be imaginative and they can contribute. And it's about having fun in rehearsals, and it's about sort of like, we're only doing this to make great work and don't take it personally. And it's just sort of put the art first and find out what people's aesthetic are. In the end, it comes down to like what people like and what they believe in and what means most to them.
I presume it's helpful, Mish, when you've worked with a company before and you already have that existing relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we're very fortunate to have had these, you know, now nearly 7 years of international collaboration and discussion about what is art and also what is funny and also what is theatre and sort of the big questions, but also the small questions of what should we do this morning, what kind of experiments can we do to make some material, or what texts can we bring in to play with. And so those things kind of layer and build as you go on working together.
Maybe you'd explain the play to us then. I hope I'm pronouncing Evil right. It's spelled Y-F-E-L, but pronounced?
Yeah, we kind of say evil, just like evil,
evil,
but
okay.
It's the medieval spelling of the word evil. And it's really, I mean, the premise of the play is almost like you've kind of burst into the Evil School of Performing Arts, and it's just a group of four people left over from an initial cohort of 16 who seem to have dropped off mysteriously, and they're kind of teaching each other how to be an artist. And it's, I think, connects to anyone who's ever had any experience or contact with drama schools or artist residencies or writing retreats or any kind of world where we try and explain and teach creativity and art form to each other, because you become very quickly aware that it's a whole bunch of very strange conventions that hold up any art form. There's a whole bunch of very culty activity that can be undertaken by people who claim to be experts. And that also that any kind of way of rigorously trying to get better at something often requires a lot of very strange rituals, which are ridiculous and absurd if you look closely at them, but at the same time can often lead to really good habits and really interesting work. So it's at once looking at the absurdity and the kind of strangeness of how we think about art, how we make art, what an artist does in their studio. What a theatre maker does in their studio is often very mysterious, I think. How does an artist work is something that we're all kind of interested in, even within artists talking to other artists. You know, what do you do when you start? How do you begin the first page of a novel? How do you write? How do you, what is the first movement you make with your body as a dancer to start making this grand opus? And it's kind of very highfalutin, but at the same time, it's often very like, well, you know what I do? I move my finger. And then after that, I move my elbow, you know, and I sort of muck around and I see what happens. And then I make a joke. And often it's very small, but it can be very, very, it lead to something very grand. And so it's sort of like zooming in and zooming out at all those strange things.
Well, I'm really glad we have a clip from Evil here. The entire cast features in the clip, but actor Faith Jones leads and Mish Grigor is in this, yourself, Marcus McKenzie and Mazzy Ronaldson as well.
Did everyone finish Goethe's Faust?
No.
I listened to an audio recording and a summary of it, but no.
No.
I know he's literally the devil, but I don't think Mephistopheles is that bad of a guy. I definitely know worse people.
Who decides who's a bad person? Is it okay to be cruel to bad people?
You just know they're bad. When someone's bad, everyone says they're bad. They must be bad.
I think it's the same even if they're good or bad. Because ultimately it's about you being cruel to them. It's not really to do with who they are as a person. So it's really about your act, not their reaction or who they are.
Yeah, you're essentially describing stooping to their level.
But no level exists because you're creating your own level.
Isn't everybody bad to somebody else? So isn't it just a free-for-all?
I'd like to interpret my answer through movement, if that works for you. It's a clearer form of communication for me. I'm going to choreograph a piece called Stooping to My Level. Can everyone follow me, please? It's called Stooping to My Level. And like the other week, you have to copy my movements exactly, okay? No free-form. This is called Stooping to My Level. Now, you keep going and let me see. You're two...
You need more?
Yeah. Chris, I know that toe's broken, but you need to point it that way. Is that easier now with your good toe?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't look easier. Musically in your repertoire, what do you think would work for this? I don't know if you heard, but it's called Stooping to My Level. So if you could hit the tone of someone stooping to your level, that would be great. As you can see back again, the movement is quite similar. It's called Stooping to My Level. Are you familiar with that term? So that term means when you stoop to someone's level. Exactly. They're all stooping to my level. The only one who can really stoop to my level is Roma. Back straight, Roma. Yeah, that's good. So we're going to flip it and face the audience. We're going to face the audience this way.
Gavin, that illustrates that it's obviously a very funny piece.
It is a very funny piece, yeah. And I think one of the things about comedy is it's if you're sitting by yourself at home at a table writing comedy, it's almost impossible to know what's funny. So with this, with physicality, with gesture, with this kind of funny setup, what you get is kind of a real alive experience on the stage. And they really are kind of battling each other, dramatically taking over, leading each other, and sort of in a way kind of like trying to inspire each other. But at the same time, they're sort of competing with each other. It's kind of like, you know, art's a competition unless you win. Art's not a competition unless you win. You know, it's real sort of, it's got that sort of free for all, but they're desperate to find out what it is they want to make. And there's a tension there, which also creates comedy. So it's sort of like mean comedy, if you like.
I understand that there are audiences attending the rehearsals. Why did you take that approach?
Well, we've been doing that for a number of years, and we found that it's interesting to sort of invite people into the rehearsal room. First of all, so performers aren't just acting at walls, but also to get a sense of like the humility required to perform. And it creates a sense of like reaction from the audience. And it also puts you at ease when you come to face the audience finally when you leave rehearsals. Sometimes it's strange, you're in rehearsals and you're sort of in a vacuum and then you're hermetically sealed and then you go to an audience and you go, oh no. But with an audience, you get to find out timing and rhythm and what's landing and you get a sense of reaction. And you also have someone to tell your story to. So it's been really good. Also, from the point of view of like allowing people into the rehearsal process, trying to build that community and sort of demystifying it in a way. And so it covers those two things, I guess.
Mish, that's something that it's obviously quite, it could potentially be quite scary for a performer, because usually those kinds of rehearsals are spaces that people aren't allowed into unless you're actually part of the production.
Yeah, I mean, there's a vulnerability to it. I think that often when you make a piece of art, you want it to be polished, you want it to be ready, you want it to be all of the kind of issues and questions that you have around it to be sort of scuffed away before you invite people in. And so there is a sort of element of risk, I would say, to saying to the public, hey, if you want to come in and see this work that is still being worked out, that is still being, they're still finding itself. That might be that a line or a character is not quite settled yet. It might be that an image doesn't quite exist in its most beautiful form. But I think that that's one of the great sort of joys of PanPan as a company, is like really thinking that, well, those moments of being in process are really important to share and to open up and to think about, well, that's part of the community of practice that can be built is by saying to people, here we are, we're vulnerable, we're like still making this work. There's nothing in an ivory tower about this practice, even though it is experimental and it's definitely thinking about innovation of the art form. That doesn't have to happen so separately from just day-to-day thinking or any other job, really.
You're from Australia. There's that old chestnut that Australia is a classless society and that theatre should be there for all the people. That's not necessarily the case in Australia, as I understand it.
No, I mean, it's a mythology that Australia likes to tell about itself, that we sort of separate from the colonising English class structure. And I mean, it's true that we don't have the same class structure that England has, thank God. But we do have, of course, hierarchies that exist, and there are different levels of the way that class functions, and that, you know, that cultural capital as opposed to can be a really radioactive point, I think, for that. Who feels comfortable to go to the theatre? Who feels comfortable to talk about art? You know, in this piece, we talk about Faust and we talk about Goethe's Faust. And this is like really in conversations about art, this is high art. You know, it's this 150-year-old German play. This guy, he was spent 60 years writing away. It's a poem, it's a play. It's the language of it is deeply complex. But at the same time, it's really contemporary. It's a really strange story about someone trying to make meaning out of life and sort of looking at history and looking at his access to information and thinking, like, what is the point of life? And can art help? Can people help? Can nature help? What is it that makes life livable, you know? And I think that that's where I think that art, that theatre and art can be really democratic, because these questions are asked by people no matter what kind of education they have. They're asked by all of us on those dark nights. It's like, what is the point of this? And am I doing it right? Should I be feeling these feelings? They're strange questions. And I think that often the institutions of theatre or galleries can feel strange or can feel separate from life, but actually they're just, you know, walls and buildings that we go into to have these questions together.
Gavin, the inclusion of that, of the themes from Faust, it asks what today's artists are willing to bargain their time, their sanity, their relationship, whatever, for a moment of inspiration or for a moment of genius.
Exactly, yeah. The premise of Faust is that he's striving. He's saying, what do I do with all this knowledge? I have all this knowledge now. How can I have more? What is the meaning of it? Is there any redemption? So in a way, we look at, like, what do these performers in this, these characters in the show, what are they striving to do? What do they have to give of themselves, or what do they lose of themselves to attain what they might not find? So it's about this Faustian journey, and what you have to do to yourself, and what you have to change in your relationships to friends, family, everyone around you, in order to sort of obsess and try to find out, try to mine this gold, or try to find this something that you, what you have to say, and also like, why are you there in the first place? Like, what gives you the right to have that point of view? So Faust links very well to that sort of striving, and that sense of, and in Faust it's really sort of an unstructured dream. It's such an unusual play. I mean, it's a play that sort of defies genre, and it's up there with sort of like, you know, the Odyssey as one of the greatest, strangest pieces, but it sort of almost came out of nowhere. So it's a great sort of backbone and a philosophical backbone to sort of like land the simpler questions as well.
Gavin Quinn of PanPan Theatre and Mish Grigor of Aphids, thanks so much for joining us on tonight's Arena. Evil will be at the Project Arts Centre from December 4th to 13th, and you'll find more details and ticketing at panpantheatre.com. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. In April 2021, we spoke with Catherine Hearns, one of three editors of Tulka, a brand new biannual literary journal set up to promote, as they call it, formerly promiscuous non-fiction. Tulka has just published its 10th edition. Two of its contributors are the fiction writers Wendy Erskine and John Patrick McHugh, and they join me now on the line. You're both very welcome to the programme. Wendy, this edition of Tulka has quite the lineup of writers. There's Rob Doyle and Ronan Heshin interviewing Jon Fosse, and you two as well. How important is the place that it holds in the Irish literary scene, specifically because of that remit of nonfiction?
Well, I think it's just it's such an interesting journal, Rick. And I think, you know, that sort of tagline of, you know, promiscuous nonfiction, it does really allow it to, you know, encompass so much stuff from, you know, reportage, travel writing, autofiction, memoir, biography, you know, there's interviews. There's just basically people chatting to each other. It just has so much in it in terms of diversity, I think.
In comparison to your fiction writing, when you're asked to write something for something like Tulka, that must be a joy.
In some ways it is, you know, because in some ways it is to be asked to write about something quite specific and quite unusual. So over the years, I've written about all sorts of things from, you know, bodybuilding to public art to, you know, fashion, clothes, what I'm writing about in Tulka here. But at the same time, I also find it hard because I think, like, whenever you're writing fiction, you're beholden to no one apart from characters that don't exist, characters that are total constructs. Whereas when you're writing non-fiction, you know, it can be compromised in some way by what you actually remember, whether or not it's true, by other people and whether or not you want to include them. Also by how you're trying to represent yourself, how you want to be perceived. So for me, in some ways, it's a much more complex thing than writing fiction, but I do enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm going to slightly unpick that a little bit later on in terms of the piece you have in the current Tulka. JP, you work at Banshee when you aren't writing fiction, and Fun and Games, the novel, came out this year to huge acclaim. What do you make of how strong a scene we have here in terms of literary journals as a whole?
Oh, we're so lucky here in Ireland. It's kind of remarkable when you look across the width and breadth of the country and all the journals that are producing. It's kind of wonderful to see, and we're really standing tall amongst us. Us and the Yanks, really, isn't it? I look at the lineup for this issue, I'm blown away. I look up the lineup for Singing Fly. It's always so exciting. So I think it's no secret why Irish writing is doing well. It's because of journalists like Tulka that are just putting names out there, that are working with writers, and that are also giving writers a place to submit their work, which is the kind of remarkable thing about journals. They allow writers to meet each other, to meet readers, and it's so exciting. So we're so lucky here in Ireland.
Yeah, it's part of a conversation that we had with Brendan Barrington at the recent live event we did for the Dublin Review anniversary. It does allow those writers who maybe necessarily haven't put together a collection of short stories, or they're working on that first novel, it gives them somewhere to meet their audience for the first place.
For sure. You know, writing is such a lonely thing. Unfortunately, it is going to be you and the desk for the most part. So being able to get a piece in a journal is so exciting. It's a huge milestone. It still, it thrills me. You know, when I see my name in Tulka, even after a book, I'm like, wow, isn't that so brilliant? So it's fantastic. And I also think, look, there's a lot of people who submit to journals and they don't get published. And that's the unfortunate thing. Only a few can get through. But there's still a lot of bravery in putting your work out there. And that ecosystem of work being submitted and being read by editors is so exciting. And from my own position in Banshee, I feel so privileged. And it's amazing. Banshee have reached 20 issues now. And then you see Tulka at 10. It just shows you how hungry we are as writers and readers in this country.
Wendy, Tulka asked you to write something for them to do with clothes or fashion for the current issue. You wrote an essay called Clobber. Tell us about it.
Well, my essay, Clobber, is essentially me just picking things from my wardrobe to start with and thinking, what kind of a story is there behind these particular clothes? And I suppose that's one of the key things whenever you're writing nonfiction, I think, that you need to try to think about. How are you going to structure this? And sometimes it's going to be that things are structured in terms of an argument, or they're going to be structured in terms of there's a central kind of framework, and you use that as a means of looking at all sorts of different aspects of experience. And I suppose that's what I was doing here, where I thought, let's think about secondhand clothes. When you wear secondhand clothes, do you ever get the vibe of the people that owned them before? You know, that was something I wanted to look at. I wanted to look at the whole idea of wearing my mum's clothes, you know, and what does that mean whenever I wear those? I wanted to look at the idea of, I was never allowed whenever I was a kid of a t-shirt with like Wendy written on it. And now I love things with Wendy. I wear a Wendy necklace and I'm obsessed with things with my name on it. So I wanted to look at that. And I suppose I just wanted to look at clothes, not looking particularly at style, as it were, or looking at fashion, but looking at clothes as in some way representing a dimension of people's lives and my life and history.
You're going to read something from it for us?
Sure, yes. I'll read the very first section. My gran left school at 13 to train as an apprentice in a workroom attached to a Belfast department store. She sewed clothes. As a kid, I would quiz her about aspects of this employment while she showed me how to do particular stitches, blanket, backstitch, chain, on pieces of kitchen roll. Was she basically a fashion designer? No. A dressmaker? No. She was an alterer. She worked on clothes that moneyed people had bought that needed to be changed to their shape and specifications. That seemed dull and disappointing. It had no creative cachet. And yet, I see it now as highly imaginative work, requiring ingenuity, daily commitment to an oulipo of hollows and accretions, a constraint of requirements and vanities.
You talk about your gran throughout the piece, Wendy. What was she like?
Well, I suppose my gran was someone in some ways quite traditional. She wasn't a flamboyant dresser in any way. She was quite a traditional person who liked to go to church on a Sunday, who liked to always wear a hat, who always liked a good coat, you know. So it wasn't like a flamboyant type of style. But she was someone who talked very, very proudly about the occupation that she had as an alterer, and was incredibly skilled, I would say, in terms of sewing, and also as well a really beautiful writer. Someone that left school at 13, and yet in terms of her actual handwriting, in terms of her actual expression, you know, it was beautiful. And, you know, she would have been in class at school of maybe, I don't know, 40, 50 kids and then left, you know, whenever she was very, very young. So I loved spending time with her. She was brilliant.
JP, I want to get to your piece. Both yourself and Wendy published novels this year, The Benefactors from Wendy, Fun and Games from You. Your Tulka essay, Voice, 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 it began in a kind of slump that you found yourself in after the novel came out?
Yeah, I suppose Liam Harrison, one of the editors, has got onto me a while ago about the idea of writing an essay. And kind of like Wendy, I'm very frightened by nonfiction. I feel very stupid when I write nonfiction in the way I don't in fiction. And I suppose this essay was me trying to explore this kind of silence that was going on in my writing. After finishing the novel and doing all the edits, I couldn't get writing again. I had no ideas. And I found that very frustrating. I'm not a very happy person when I'm not writing. So this essay was an attempt for me to kind of unravel that, but also think about voice in general, voice in writing, voice that's in my head, but also the voice that goes on in writing and playing sports and all those kind of different ideas in one kind of text.
Okay, and you're going to read from Voice, Voice, Voice.
Yes, I'm going to read from a bit in the middle. My formal introduction to voice was in college in a module entitled The Forms of Fiction. I was 18, and on the first day, I listened as a tutor expounded on terms like structure, perceptive, voice, feeling very stupid and very lost. Authors were mentioned like the names of foreign countries, Borges, Austen, Chekhov, and I hunched down, avoiding the tutor's eye so she couldn't discern that I'd encountered none of these writers. Eventually, sheets were passed along, the reading for next week, and I rolled up mine with a deepening conviction that I was in the wrong room, the wrong course entirely, that I was sinking through the floor, in fact. And then I read the story. It was called Araby, and I was spooked. James Joyce knew me. No, worse, the fella had robbed from me. because my body glowed when I galloped about the estate as a kid, and I vividly remembered that as a private sensation, and it was all mine, and how did this dead man possibly know that? A breathless and exhilarating experience, reading this one sentence repeatedly, a sincere, if comical, experience. The mirror image struck, the thrill of recognition in another's work, and that short line, the cold air stung us, and we played till our bodies glowed, spoke to me only me, and I suffered. No retrospective goss here, no phony exaggeration, a Joycean epiphany that writing could be art.
You write in the piece as well about voice, whether you're playing soccer or Gaelic football when you were younger as well. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because voice is, it kind of, the whole thing kind of starts out in a kind of a gloomy note when I look at mental health and voice. But I was so interested in voice as just a concept that goes throughout my life. And in writing, when I write, I hear nothing. I just, when I'm writing fiction, it's all quiet in my head. And when I think back to soccer and Gaelic, it's almost like my writing, in that in Gaelic, I was considered good. I'd always start. So I'd never used to hear anything in my head when I play Gaelic. But when it came to soccer, my feet are quite clumpy. I can't turn around very quickly. So I used to always hear in my head all the negatives, all the critiques. And I kind of found that fascinating to look at. And I find it's very difficult as an Irish person, you know, to talk about being good at something. It's even harder, I found, to write about being good at something, even if you're average at it. So it was, again, it was an idea of exploring voice through that and just seeing what it means. What goes through your head when you play something that you're good at and when you play at something when you're not that good at it?
Wendy, you had a look at another essay in this particular Tolka journal first, the one by Hannah Sargent.
Yes, I thought this was an absolutely beautiful essay, Bury Me Standing Up. So in this essay, Hannah Sargent quite explicitly sets out what she's trying to do at one point, and she says she wants to document a portrait of her dad, who has died. He's died 20 years ago, and she wants to document this portrait of him through the lens of her own eyes. So essentially she's trying to reconstruct her dad from what's left behind in terms of personal effects, in terms of invoices for his funeral, in terms of artifacts, in terms of his old music, his records, in terms of the art that he did, in terms of his memorial book. And she's trying to establish who and what her dad was. And of course, as we know, you know, any person is going to be so much more than their personal effects. And it's very, very interesting, the discovery she makes. It's a very tender piece, very, very honest piece. She says it's through her own eyes, but as well, she's very generous in terms of the way in which she incorporates other people's perspectives as well of her father. So I thought it was a beautiful essay.
Just to maybe try and bring this all full circle, Wendy, in your own essay, you question yourself in the telling of the story. You're asking yourself if you're, and this is a quote, including a cliche of the personal essay, the money shot moment of personal revelation. Why be so hard on yourself?
Well, I don't think there's any point in writing if you're not going to be hard on yourself. If you're not going to be stringent on yourself, and if you're not going to push yourself and really question what it is you're doing, then I really do think, why bother? Because you're probably going to produce something that's kind of flabby if you don't. So with me, I was thinking about, well, what are these kind of things that people reach for in the personal essay? And sometimes it is that. It's the money shot moment, the big sort of revelation that's going to elevate your essay beyond the sort of mundane. And, you know, so I wanted to talk about one of the things that happened to me whenever I was in a shop when my dad was buying some polo shirts to go on holiday, was that we were actually in a ball. And I thought, do I really want to mention this? And am I in some way maxing my troubles credentials or something? Or why am I including this in an essay on clothes? And then I thought, well, how important that I should include this in an essay on clothes? Because this happened when we were in a clothes shop, when we were looking at trousers with elasticated waists and, you know, polo shirts. So after my sort of inquiry, I actually felt happy enough to include it.
JP, you found yourself in a sort of writing slump before you wrote the essay for this. Did the essay bring you back to writing fiction again?
It definitely helped. It kind of, and I loved hearing there what Wendy said about honesty. And I think honesty is the one thing I always look for in nonfiction, that brutalness that you can get at with a nonfiction. I think in this essay, I was kind of trying to be brutal and honest about what it feels like to not write and how tough that can be. But yeah, no, this essay and kind of being published, it gives you such a lift. As I said, you know, it doesn't matter if it's your first publication or your fifth. The joy of seeing your name in print, to be surrounded by other writers, to be able to discover new writing, it's really, yeah, it's so gratifying and I'm so grateful. And yeah, no, I'm back writing, thankfully. And yeah, this essay, I think it was important for me to write it temporally when I'm right in the moment and kind of just look at that feeling, which isn't always very pleasant, but to really kind of capture it accurately.
And Wendy, how about you? You working on new short stories, new novel?
I'm working on a new novel, and I've never stopped working on short stories really the whole time. But I just agree so much with JP. It's just such a thrill to see yourself in print. It never grew tired of that. It's wonderful.
It's been brilliant to talk to both of you tonight, Wendy Erskine and John Patrick McHugh. Thanks a million for joining us on Arena.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations to the three editors of Tulka, Catherine Hearn, Liam Harrison and Sean Hayes. The 10th edition of the Tulka Literary Journal is out now, and you'll find out details of that at tulkajournal.org. And that is it for tonight's Arena, produced by Reg Luby. Leah Murphy was our researcher. Tonight, broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Sound supervision by Harry Bookless. I'm Rick O'Shea. I will talk to you again tomorrow night from 7 here on RTE Radio 1. And up at the far side of the news is John Creedon.